From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The University of Tennessee is making a big promise. Starting in 2020, the system will offer free tuition to qualifying low-income students enrolling at its Knoxville, Chattanooga, and Martin campuses. The program is called UT Promise, and it is the first of its kind among public universities in the South. UT Interim President Randy Boyd is the architect of the program and with us from WUOT in Knoxville. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Virginia. Thanks for having us today.
Well, thank you for being here. So the University of Tennessee currently enrolls about 51,000 students, three campuses, various institutes. So the promise will help qualifying students with tuition and fees. How do they qualify?
Well, they just have to earn it academically. We didn't want any students that could earn the right to come to our college through their academics to be excluded because they didn't have the finances to pay. So if you could academically earn the right to get entrance to either one of our universities, then you will be able to come free of tuition and fees.
So what is that you said of a certain income level? Under $50,000 is it household income?
So we set the target at under $50,000. The median household income in the state of Tennessee is $48,000. So over half the population in the state of Tennessee should be able to qualify for this program, as long as they can qualify academically.
And the HOPE scholarship is part of the qualification, so they must be residents of Tennessee. For how long?
That would be dependent on the HOPE scholarship requirements, but I believe it's 12 months. So they have to live in Tennessee for 12 months to be able to qualify.
So why this program in Tennessee and why now?
Well, the mission of the University of Tennessee is, as the land-grant university, is to provide a ladder up for the middle class and the working class. If you look back in 1862 and President Lincoln helped initiate the Morrell Act, which created all the land-grant universities across the country, our mission was to be the ladder up for the working class and the middle class, giving them an opportunity to a better education, better job, and a better life. And so we want to make sure we fulfill that mission. We want to measure our success not by our exclusivity. There's too many universities that seem to measure and take a sense of pride in how many students they don't allow in. We want to be the opposite. We want to be a university of inclusivity and finding ways for more people to come in and take advantage of the opportunities we offer.
Well, as you said, those universities and that promise has been, or let's say that mandate has been there for more than 100 years. How has it not been fulfilled?
I think over the years, and part of it because of the way state funding has changed, you know, 20 years ago, 70% of the funding that went to public universities came from the states. And then gradually, as states have had tighter and tighter budgets, it's declined to only about 30%. And the difference has been borne by the students. And so college has gotten more and more expensive. And so we're worried that we're making it more difficult for some of our lower income students to be able to come. So this takes care of that. If you're less than the 50% of the household income in the state of Tennessee, you'll be able to enter our colleges free of tuition and fees.
So what is it particularly about Tennessee and actually your personal story, which is very interesting? Your background is in business. Prior to becoming interim president of the UT system, you were chair of Tennessee's Higher Education Commission, first in your family to graduate from college at UT. So how did education become the priority for you, both personally and then as a policymaker and administrator?
Well, I owe a lot to the opportunity to be able to come to the University of Tennessee. I was the first in my family's history to come to UT, or the first one in my family's history to ever graduate from a university. And it meant so much to me in my life. And I've been dedicating the rest of my life to trying to give back. And I believe that education is the inflection point of everything. If you want to give back, the best place to give back is to provide other people the opportunity to get a great education. And post-secondary access has been one of the bigger challenges across the country. And so we started small with a small pilot in Knoxville to send students to community colleges and technical colleges free, matched with a mentor, which is extremely important, and requiring them to have some skin in the games, a community service project each semester. That led to something called Tennessee Achieves, which led to something called the Tennessee Promise that now sends every student in the state of Tennessee to technical community college free of charge. We created an endowment, so it's guaranteed forever. And based on those ideas and that experience, we created the UT Promise.
How did you pay for college?
So My dad made me a great offer that I look back on, I think was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me. He said, look, we can't afford to pay your way to college, but I can give you a job. He had a factory. So I ran injection molding machines, two 12-hour shifts, the midnight shift from 7 p.m. on Saturday night to 7 a.m. Sunday morning, and then the same thing on the Sunday night, which didn't do much for my social life, but did allow me to graduate from UT with honors and with no debt at the age of 19.
Wow. So you were appointed interim president of the University of Tennessee. This was just in September of last year, and you've created this program in that time. How did you win support for a pretty revolutionary initiative in such a short time?
Well, I think the state of Tennessee had already created this culture of finding ways to provide more opportunity. So we're building on a culture that was already within our state. And the logistics of it, the math of it, makes sense. And so we went to all of our chancellors. They all wanted to do something to improve access, and this was the right solution.
So with the program that you did, the earlier program, this was in the community colleges, the two-year program, Tennessee
right.
Promise, I think it was called. That came under some scrutiny for only covering tuition, leaving students with unmanageable costs in housing and textbooks. How are you going to solve that with the UT Promise?
Well, so I maybe beg to differ on the premise, because at community colleges and the technical colleges, they're not residency schools. People commute to those schools. So there's not really housing or other costs outside of books, which books is an issue. Interesting stat, the first two cohorts from the Tennessee Promise, 95% of them graduated with zero debt. At the University of Tennessee, right now, 46% of our students graduate with no debt. With this program, we're thinking it does three things. One, it will help more students access the University of Tennessee system. Two, we think it will help us with retention, because they're not going to be as burdened with finances. And three, they'll be able to graduate with less debt.
Randy Boyd, please stay with us. We're speaking with University of Tennessee Interim President Randy Boyd, and continue our conversation after a short break. But first, an appeal to all of you lifelong learners who rely on the information that GPB provides to deepen your understanding of our region, our country, and our world. I'm Virginia Prescott, here asking you to join with listeners across the state and beyond to help cover the costs of news, information, and conversations you get from GPB. That is really how public radio works, and that's what our Spring Fund Drive is all about. Our doors are open, and we hope you'll be the next listener to join the GPB family. Here's Tom Barkley to tell you how. We are back with On Second Thought from GPB. I'm Virginia Prescott with Randy Boyd. He's been making some bold moves as University of Tennessee's interim president. He's the architect of UT Promise, the program which will waive tuition and fees for students with family household incomes of less than $50,000. It is the first program of its kind at a public university in the South. So, Randy, a lot of people are going to be eligible for this. How are you going to pay for it?
Well, it turns out that the University of Tennessee system has about $295 million a year in tuition and fees and scholarship support already. About $136 million of that comes from the institutions. We estimate this cost to be about $5.9 million a year. So it's roughly 1.5% of the total, and only about 4% of what the institutions do. So we believe it's at a very affordable range. And the part of that is because many of these students already are going to be qualified for a high percentage of Pell and HOPE. But the other way in which we're going to offset the cost is through our volunteers all across the country, the alumni that believe in the program and believe in the future of our students. And so we're creating an endowment. We haven't announced the target yet, but we're going to raise an endowment, much like what Rice University did to do a similar program. And that endowment, we believe, can cover the cost for not just in the short term, but forever. And that's a big project that we have going on just now.
Well, until that endowment comes through, it is the state taxpayers who are helping to fund the system. What has the feedback been from them on this program?
Well, we're not asking for any additional state dollars. We're finding ways to reallocate funds within the system and save money in other areas.
In Georgia, the HOPE and Zell Miller scholarships cover tuition and fees up to a certain amount for high-performing students. How does the UT Promise program differ from other state-sponsored financial aid programs?
Well, this just builds on top of the state program. You know, the state of Tennessee has a HOPE scholarship program, just like the state of Georgia. And while that's a great benefit, unfortunately, the tuition and fees has increased at a greater rate then states have been able to increase the Hope Scholarship. So now there's a gap. When the Hope Scholarships were created at the time, they were thought to be able to cover tuition and fees. Now they don't. So the UT Promise covers that gap.
What is the tuition for a student at UT now, average?
So on in-state, at the when we have three campuses, at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, it's a little above $12,000. At UT Chattanooga, around $9,000. UT Martin, around $8,000.
How many students do you project? Will your enrollment increase greatly after this?
Yeah, we hope so, and that's the idea. We're estimating somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000 additional students in the next year.
One of the parts of UT Promise is matching students with volunteer mentors to help ensure success, reading from the UT website. How are you identifying mentors, and how will they help students?
Yeah, I think that's such a critical component. So it's not just about access. It's great getting students in, but if they don't graduate, if they don't get out, then we haven't lived up to our mission. And so it's not just about access, it's about success. And to do that, we'll be matching them all with volunteer mentors. We'll get mentors from faculty, from alumni, from other people in the community to match up with them. And we know we can do it. And with Tennessee Promise, the statewide program for community college, each year we recruit over 9,500 mentors. We train them. We match them with students. So this isn't something new that we have to invent. We just have to model after what we're already doing in our state.
Yeah. So I think this is a big challenge here. I was reading recently about Stuyvesant High School. You know that in New York City, it's one of these high-performing schools. And in high-performance schools, people know about this entrance exam to get into it, but students in lower-performing schools completely unprepared because they weren't taught or it wasn't prioritized. So how are you communicating the UT Promise? What is available throughout the K-12 system there in the state?
Yeah, so we're working on a plan now, but one of the key parts of this whole program is to communicate this statewide, and not just to graduating seniors, but to kindergartners and their parents. Because I think our biggest challenge in our state is our culture, a culture of low expectations. And that culture is based on the assumption by many parents that their children could never afford to send their children to school. So we're hopeful that we can begin to let them know that if your child will work hard academically to earn the right to come in, money won't be a barrier. So we're hopeful that not only will we increase access and success, but will it change the culture of the state of Tennessee, one of higher expectations for our children.
And lower student loan debt. That is going to affect the future in a huge way, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely. We're already one of the lowest states in the country for student graduation date across the state. But with this, I think it'll dramatically lower it still.
Now, this is something that has been a big deal on the presidential trail. Multiple progressive candidates have talked about running on universal higher education, so free higher education. Have you been contacted by other states in the South and elsewhere that want to create a program like this?
Well, yeah, I'm on the board of College Promise, which is a national organization that has been promoting this nationally. I think that, you know, that Tennessee had the advantage of starting small. We were an overnight success. It took us 10 years to get there. You know, started off in Knox County, moved across 26 other counties, then made it statewide. Now the UT Promise is building on that model. So we've had a long time to work on it. But there's an opportunity for other states to do this as well, and I'm hopeful that they do.
Randy Boyd, if you're looking 10, 20 years into the future, what do you see in this program and how it's going to pay off?
Well, one of our missions also is to support the state, and the state's mission is to complete what we call the Drive to 55. By the year 2025, we want 55% of our population with something beyond high school. It doesn't always have to be a four-year degree, but some certificate or skill beyond high school. Today, we're at 42%. A key part of what we need to do as the University of Tennessee, being the leader in providing talent for the state, is to make sure we're doing our part. And this will help us do our part so the state can be successful.
Randy Boyd, I wish you all the best. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Virginia. We appreciate the time.
Randy Boyd, he's University of Tennessee interim president and the architect of the UT Promise program. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Most people do whatever they can to escape tragedies. Russell Lewis hustles to get to them, like when Hurricane Harvey touched down in Texas in 2017.
I was driving from Austin to Corpus Christi, and I was just watching the mass exodus, the mass evacuations of people fleeing the coast. And there was one car that was driving towards the coast, and it was me.
Russell's official title is NPR Southern Bureau Chief. He's stationed in Alabama, but he is the go-to guy on NPR's Go Team, which covers earthquakes, floods, fires, and other natural disasters, as well as those caused by humans, terrorist attacks, industrial accidents, and mass shootings. Russell is often the first member of the team on a plane and on the ground, setting up logistics, drivers, translators, and supplies in places where systems have broken down, so NPR can bring those events to you. I caught up with him at WBHM in Alabama. Edith Chapin, she's an executive editor at NPR News. She told Current magazine, that's a publication for public broadcasting, that you are an army of one. We deploy him as a circus master, jack of all trades, and leader of many when big stories break in both the U.S. and overseas. You mentioned Corpus Christi, Hurricane Harvey, earthquake in Haiti, in Nepal, Hurricane Katrina, the Paris terror attacks, Sandy Hook. So what happens when you get the word? What's the first thing you do?
Well, often I don't have a lot of time, and I often know that when there's a big story that's developing, I just kind of know I'm going to be tasked to go. In my office, I have what I call my go kit. It's a backpack that is fully packed that has all of my sort of basic essentials that I need, and then I fill it up with other things depending on where I'm going. When the Paris attacks happened in 2015, the very first sort of alerts that came in that there was some sort of activity that was going on in Paris, some shootings and some possible explosions. That happened at about, if I remember correctly, about 2:30 Central Time. And I was on a plane to Paris, at 4:30.
Wow.
2-hour turnaround. That's the fastest I've ever deployed. And when I was on the plane, there was the chatter that all of the airports in France were going to be closed because they thought that they were completely under attack and they were going to close the airport. So when I was on that flight to Paris, I actually wasn't sure where it was I was going to end up. I thought I might, you know, eventually end up in Amsterdam or Brussels, perhaps Madrid, and then have to make my way to Paris taking a train or running a car. And so that's part of it, is that even as I was on my way to Paris, I wasn't sure where I was going to end up. And of course, that story broadened out, as you remember.
Mm-hmm,
you know, the terrorists were did a lot of their training in Belgium and Brussels. And so we then had to send crews of reporters up to Brussels to cover that part of the story. And so you have to be nimble and you have to be quick. And in this case, because you were 7 and 8 hours ahead of the Eastern time zone, I on the ground, in addition to sort of coordinating our coverage, had to make all of the calls about where to send people. Every big breaking story is different, and you just have to sort of be ready for it and to sort of roll with the punches as they happen.
My guest is Russell Lewis. He's NPR's Southern Bureau Chief, stationed in Alabama. He's also an essential member of NPR's Go Team. Those are producers and reporters that cover disasters, man-made and natural, all over the globe. Russell, many stories broaden out. In fact, you stayed in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina for a year. So what happens after a tragedy? How does that kind of context and way that you approach a story shift?
Hurricane Katrina, you remember in 2005 when that hurricane had entered the Gulf of Mexico and it was making a beeline for Louisiana and Mississippi. It was a massive storm. And, you know, ultimately that storm killed 1,800 people. We knew it was going to be a big story. We knew it was going to be a hard story to cover. And so we created a bureau, and eventually I was based in New Orleans, as you say, for a year. And it's quite a bit different when you are living in a place where the disaster happened. You know, oftentimes the national media, they go to the place where the thing happened, and they're there for a day, a two or three, or maybe a week, or maybe 2 weeks, and maybe they're there up to a month. But the difference is, for a story like Katrina, is that it was a multi-year story. The recovery, the rebuilding, the questions about the federal government's responsibility, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the levees and flood walls that failed ultimately. But the hard thing for any journalist, especially when it's a local journalist, is that when you're there day by day, living it day to day, it's hard. It's hard to see the damage and destruction. I had to regularly drive through an area that was flooded out. You see it day by day, and you don't ever see the change. And it starts to wear on you personally, physically. Like you see this thing that's damaged and nothing is being done to make it better. And that's a challenge. It's a challenge not just for journalists, but just for everyday people, people who live in that place, to see that devastation, to see the destruction. And it's a daily reminder of the bad thing that happened, of the thing that came in and upended so many people's lives. And you see it when there are tornadoes, you know, for the people who have to come and go in those neighborhoods, and they leave in the morning to go to work, and then they come home in the afternoon, or for the kids who, you know, have to see it when they're out playing in their front yards. It's hard. It wears on you. It's emotionally draining. And that is one of the, you know, the unsung things that, you know, really affect people. And on some levels, there are survivors of these big disasters that end up having post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Mm-hmm. But it is something, as humans, you know, we're a very resilient group of folks. You have to sort of see it, and you have to sort of deal with it and move on. But it is certainly one of the big challenges.
Russell's work and everything you hear on GPB are supported by you. And your support right now makes a big difference in our ability to provide smart, relevant programs on the air for you and your community every single day. I'm Virginia Prescott, reminding you that our Spring Fund Drive is in progress. And if we haven't heard from you yet, make this the time that you join us for the first time, or you renew your support, or better yet, become a GPB sustainer with a monthly contribution. Here's how. This is Georgia Public Broadcasting with On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Russell Lewis. He's NPR's Southern Bureau Chief. He's stationed in Alabama most days. But then there are many days when he's on the road as a member of NPR's GO team. These are producers and reporters which cover all kinds of disasters. He's on the ground, sometimes the first person there, to get things together, organize logistics so that reporters can tell those stories to you. You just talked about how difficult it is for people who are witnessing devastation and being reminded of it every single day. You are going, and reporters are going, and talking to people on that worst day, often continuing for months. So what is that conversation like? What kind of things do you think about as you're approaching them?
Well, I think first and foremost, it's important to remember that we're all human beings. You have to treat people with respect, and you have to understand that they've just been through what is probably one of the worst days of their lives, and they've survived it. And maybe some of their family members and friends didn't. One of the first things that I always do is I ask somebody, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. Are you okay? And I don't do that necessarily with my microphone out. I'm just showing them that I'm a person and that I'm understanding the difficulties that they're going through. But if there's one thing that I've noticed time and time again of natural disasters, is that people want to talk. It's cathartic for them in some ways to lay it out on the line, to tell what they're going through, how they're feeling. I think back a lot to one particular instance after the Haiti earthquake in 2010. It hit near Port-au-Prince, the capital. Haiti, of course, is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. And I was running supplies between Santo Domingo and the Dominican Republic into Port-au-Prince for our team on the ground. And Port-au-Prince in particular is a place where people are always walking. People are walking everywhere. And so after the earthquake, of course, when I was into Port-au-Prince and driving around, there were just people everywhere, walking around. And I remember a little girl. She must have been 4 or 5 years old. And she was in this group of people who were walking. And I could tell that she was by herself, that she was on her own. And she was clutching an infant. And that child couldn't have been more than, you know, 6, 7, 8 months old. And so you have this little girl. She's like 4 or 5 years old. And she's clutching this infant. And she's walking. And she had this steely determination in her eyes as she was walking. I think about that girl a lot. I don't know her story, but I've always wondered, you know, did she lose her parents in the earthquake? Is she now the principal caretaker of this little infant? And there was something about that she just felt the need to step up. That was 9 years ago. There are lots of little stories like that stick with me as a journalist. I always think back to the people that I leave behind. I wonder how they're doing, and I hope that they appreciate the fact that we come in to tell their stories, to at least shine the light to the rest of the world, to say, hey, this really bad thing happened to people, and, you know, they need help. Their stories need telling.
So you have to, let's say, compartmentalize parts of yourself in order to do this work, I imagine. You know, you're all about the logistics and getting things done and being human as you're approaching people in stories. That's something that you have done for a long time. And I know that you've been active with the DART Center for Journalism and Trauma. So you are training people to be reporters in these kind of events and take care of themselves emotionally. So how about your teams? Are there signs that you've seen that your people really just don't have the capacity to cover these kind of events?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I think back to the Sandy Hook elementary school shootings, and, you know, we remember what happened. The gunman entered the elementary school. He shot and killed 20 elementary students and six adults. I was actually the lead editor of that story just quite by happen chance. I remember having to send one of our reporters from New York to get there quickly. And then I flew to Newtown, Connecticut that evening, and I got there that night. And I checked in with my reporter who I had sent the next morning. And I said, hey, how are you doing? And he says, I'm not doing well. This is too hard. He says, they were little kids. You know, their lives hadn't been lived yet. He goes, I can't be here. And for me, that was my like moment right at that moment. It dawned on me, we have to cycle the journalists in rapidly. Hmm. We have to put them in, but only keep them there for a day or two or three. Now, normally in a typical disaster, you send somebody in for a week or two. But I ran that all the way to the flagpole to the highest levels of the NPR news division to say, we cannot keep people here on the ground for long periods of time. This is a different story. And I think it's important to remember, too, that it's not just the frontline people who are affected. You could have editors of a story who are based in Washington who are editing all these stories and listening to all of these horrible things, and it affects them. It could be the people who work on our website who, you know, have to look at images of these things that are cropping images to put them on our website and seeing that kind of stuff day in and day out. And it can be receptionists who are answering the phone and hearing these tough stories from people. And you have to sort of be mindful of that. And as a manager of your team, you have to just sort of look out for them. And I think one of the things that I think it's important to do is to always ask your people, how are you doing? It's important to remember that reporters are not robots. They're people. And they're affected by what they see and what they cover. And it is important to remember that you need to give them a break sometimes, because if you don't give them a break, then they will break. There will come a point where they crack and they can't do anything more. And we should never, ever do that. People should never, ever feel like that their jobs, you know, have cracked them. Because if that happens, then we haven't done our job looking out for our staff.
Well, Russell Lewis, I realize that many of the stories, painful as they are, that we've heard about things that have gone on in the world have been in part thanks to you. And I'm grateful for your time today. And thank you so much for doing that work.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.